Okay, I'm going to call the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. The time is, 4:21. Today's Friday, April 13th. And members present is Vice Chair Giesel, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilson, and I think Senator Egan will be here shortly, and myself, Senator Meyer. And staff, is Christine is here. Thank you, Christine. And we have Chris Dick Rowe came back. Thank you, Chris. Yes. And but we have a new LIO monitor, Max. Max Stanley. Thank you, Max. Okay, so today's agenda, we just have two items, House Bill 136, Motor Vehicle Franchises, and Senate Joint Resolution 9, Constitutional Amendment Permanent Fund Appropriation by Senator Stedman. So if there's something coming before the committee, I'd like to go ahead and take up House Bill 136 first. And I know, Sarah, if you want to join us, I know Representative Klayman had mentioned that he would probably be on the floor, so this is that certainly understandable this time of year. So, Ms. Perman, I'm going to give you the floor, and if you could introduce the bill to us and walk us through a sectional when you're ready. And Senator Egan, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Perman. I'm a staff representative, Matt Klayman, who is a the House District 21 representative for West Anchorage. I'd like to thank the members of the committee for having me here today to present House Bill 136, and I'd also like to take a moment to say we've had the great pleasure of working with Chairman Meyer and his staff on this legislation because he's the sponsor of the Senate Companion Bill SB 47. The driving forces behind House Bill 136 were the repeated conversations about the need to statutorily update franchise agreements between auto dealers and auto manufacturers. Much of this discussion was driven by issues with warranty practices and franchise termination. When we first introduced this bill last year, it looked very different. However, we had trouble getting it out of first gear when we hit a speed bump with the auto manufacturers.
That's good.
With their concerns in mind, we decided to throw the bill in reverse and work to find a compromise between all parties. While the bill idled in House Transportation Committee, Rep. Klayman and Senator Meyer brought both manufacturers and auto dealers to the table, and we've worked out a revision that is now acceptable to both auto dealers and manufacturers. This is the version in front of you today. This CS of House Bill 136 updates warranty policy to be more consumer-friendly. It provides customers who live in remote locations, either off the road system or more than 100 miles from a dealer, with a reasonable option for warranty repair coverage. As it stands, customers currently need to pay to get their vehicle to and from an authorized dealer for warranty repairs. With House Bill 136, the manufacturer will be responsible for warranty repairs in the remote location or shipping the vehicle to and from an authorized location at no cost to the consumer. House Bill 136 also updates the rates that manufacturers may pay auto dealers for warranty work. The updated rates may not be less than the rates that the auto dealer charges customers for similar non-warranty retail work. This equalizes the rate for repair work across the board. Shifting gears, House Bill 136 amends statutes concerning terminations and succession for franchises. Manufacturers must have good cause for terminating the franchise and must provide dealers with notice and allow dealers to attempt to fix areas out of compliance with franchise agreements before terminating the dealer. During the sale of a franchise, a manufacturer must also take into consideration whether the potential buyer is an immediate family member, partial owner, or meets the standard requirements when approving the sale. With that, I'll briefly go over the details of the bill. I had hoped to pass the steering wheel to Rep. Klayman, but he has unfortunately stalled in the House floor.
That's good.
To keep it brief, I'd like to just focus on the substantial parts of this bill. So I'll start by going over Section 3. Section 3 is about dealership terminations. Manufacturers may not terminate dealers without good cause and meeting the proper notice requirements. Section 4 expands upon that good cause. If a dealer cannot meet sales goals due to factors out of the dealer's control, such as lack of inventory or delayed shipments, it does not amount to good cause for termination. Section 5, when terminating dealerships, must repurchase all current year models, certain new motor vehicles from the previous year, trademark signs, parts, tools, computers, and equipment. Section 8 is about the transfer of dealerships. Manufacturers are given the right of first refusal for transfers. However, they may not prevent the transfer of a dealership if the potential buyer is capable of being licensed as an auto dealer and meets the manufacturer's standards. Manufacturers also may not reject the transfer of a dealership to an immediate family member of the current owner or a managerial employee who owns 15% or more of the dealership. Section 12 covers warranties. Manufacturers have the burden of repairing warrantied vehicles for consumers that live in remote off-road locations or more than 100 miles from a dealership. This is places like Kodiak or Nome, where someone may have a brand new Mercedes, but there isn't a Mercedes dealer in town. They have the burden of repairing it either in the location or paying for it to be transferred to an authorized shop and then paying for it to come back at no cost to the consumer. This section also changes the rates dealers are paid for warranty work to match the amount they are paid for non-warranty retail work. Section 13 lists unfair practices, and among these, manufacturers may not require unreasonable advertising displays or require dealers to join advertising associations. And this really covers the thick of the bill, so if the members have any questions, I'd be happy to help answer.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Perman. Any questions for the sponsor staff, Senator Wilson?
Thank you, Chair Meyer. I guess my shipping costs, do you know, I don't know what the average cost is to ship a, and this is okay with, you said it's okay with everyone, but I don't know if anyone is online to testify from the Manufacturers Association to, you know, ship a cost, a car or a vehicle to Nome, St. Paul. You know, those are pretty hefty costs. So I didn't know what those costs might be or associated with, or just make sure that's okay. I mean, it sounds like a wonderful deal.
Sure, and through the chair to Representative Wilson, I don't believe we have anyone from the manufacturers available with us today, but I can tell you a little more about the the cause for this section of the bill. They had concerns that if there's someone, say, in Nome who needed warranty work done, a dealer was previously responsible, and if they couldn't bring it back to, say, a hub like Anchorage, they were putting it out to a third party to do this work, and the manufacturer couldn't guarantee that the work was being done to the warranty repaired standards. And then they're worried that their brand, of course, this vehicle, which is now under warranty, has had less than sufficient warranty work done on it, and it's damaging the brand and the reputation. So they would just as soon prefer to take on the burden of doing the maintenance themselves rather than having a third party, an uncertified person doing it via the dealer, having the dealer running that bit of transaction. So,
yeah, go ahead, Senator Wilson.
For a follow-up then, I guess whose time frame or who sets this motion of transporting the vehicles in motion? Is it the manufacturer? Is it the dealer? I just, like, if you take a barge from Umanuk or, you know, or going to the Yukon, somewhere up the Yukon, barge into Nanana or somewhere else down, is it on the barge schedule, winter, or I just don't know how that's all set up. It sounds like it.
Through the chair, I'm actually not sure of that, and I know that that burden falls entirely on the manufacturer, so they are responsible for figuring out the system, but I'm not sure about the timeline.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Wilson, we do have some folks online, but as Ms. Perman said, there is no one from the manufacturers, but Gary Sleeper is with the Automobile Dealers Association, and he's available for questions, and then we will have some dealers available that want to testify as well. So they may have a better idea how that works. Senator Wilson, thank you. Senator Caulfield.
This may be for her or maybe for other testimony, but I think all we need for me to get on record is how this new law will affect existing franchises. Is it a requirement that they conform immediately? What's the fold-in process? Because I think some of them are contractual. So the sponsor knows. But I just think we need to get that on the record, how it looks.
Okay. Ms. Barber.
Sure, and I, through the chair, I'm not sure that I am the right person to answer that question. So I may defer that to the lawyer for the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, Gary Sleeper.
Gary Sleeper. Mr. Sleeper, are you on the line?
Mr. Chairman, this is Gary Sleeper, yes.
Yes, okay. Mr. Sleeper, did you happen to hear Senator Coghill's question?
Yes, I did. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the way the bill was drafted was to identify or to set out the fact that it's intended to be remedial. and that it is intended to apply to existing franchise agreements, but only to the extent permitted by the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the United States Constitution. And that provision was approved by the manufacturers. And let me, if I can just respond to where the manufacturers are on this, because Representative Klayman is not here. We met with the manufacturers' representatives and discussed this bill in detail. And they told us that at the end of the process, the best that we could hope for was that the manufacturer, they face these bills every year in every state, and they don't like to see any of them passed. And so they told us that the best that they could do and that we could hope for at the end of this process was that they would not oppose the bill. And so they have not appeared at any of the committee meetings or hearings, and they haven't put in any opposition. They're just not being heard, which is essentially sort of an implied consent. So at any rate, the retroactive feature of the bill, to the extent it can be applied retroactively, was discussed with the manufacturers. They're comfortable with this language. And what we all understand is that any particular instance when the statute is applied to an existing franchise, it may or may not be applied retroactively depending upon the particular provision at stake. And it may have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. But the intent was that the bill would apply to existing statutes to the extent that it can be done under the Alaska and the United States Constitution.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. And I think that needs to be on the record. And then the other thing that could help us, help me with some comfort level, is I know that many of the franchise manufacturers can come down with requirements from time to time. And so this gives you a backdrop, I think, for some protection on that. So franchises normally have an advertising and requirement for quality and volume. Does this, at this point, give you enough protection that that is Alaska unique that you feel could be responsive to those and yet still be able to deal with them?
Was that for me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it is, Mr. Sillipier.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator. Yes, it and appreciate that question. It really does address this. There are Section 13 identifies a couple of new what are called unfair practices, and there's a new section added to basically say that the manufacturers cannot require a new motor vehicle dealer to purchase unreasonable advertising displays or other materials or an unreasonable number of signs. And what the intent was there is to give the Alaska dealers the right to push back a little bit when manufacturers try to require Alaska dealers to participate in expensive advertising campaigns, many of which have are designed for a national audience rather than the Alaska audience. So, yes, there is protection for dealers under the HB 136.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill?
Then on the arbitration part of this, is this new a new technique, or is this an application of something that you're used to doing at this point?
It's what I understand they call a technical and conforming amendment. There was no change from the existing law.
Thank you.
It's just to correctly cite the statute.
Thank you, Senator Caulfield. Thank you, Mr. Sleeper. Are there other questions for the sponsor? Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just I feel I should support this, but then I'm hesitant because the dealer in the room charged me way too much for my brand new car.
Do you want to put on the record you have a conflict of interest?
I don't know if buying a brand new car. Actually, Mr. Allwine was on vacation when I bought it. So
okay.
I didn't get a discount, I don't think.
Okay, thank you, Senator Egan. Other questions? Okay, thank you, Sarah. And Sarah, thank you for giving me partial credit for this, but all the credit belongs to you and Representative Klayman. You spent many, many hours on this. I think I might have spent the first hour, and that's about it, because I didn't think it was going to be possible to get both groups in agreement, but somehow you pulled a rabbit out of the hat and made it happen. And by the way, Senator Coghill has been trying to get this passed for many years as well, so it's this vehicle has been going many miles, and I want to thank you for not wrecking this vehicle and keeping it on the road. Okay. So with that, let's go to public testimony. We'll start out with Martin Martinson, the owner of Continental Auto Group. Mr. Martinson.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Meyer. Appreciate it. And I'd like to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'll keep it short. I thought Sarah said it very, very well, so I don't need to go back over the issues. Senator Meyer, you just mentioned how long we've been working on this, and we started over 4 years ago working on this. And it's been a very long and trying process. Initially, this bill was over 30 pages long, and because of Representative Klayman's expertise on it, he recommended that we pare it down. And, you know, I've been at this for about 15 years, and I've never had either a representative or a senator sponsored a bill in the way that Representative Klayman did. He put all his energy behind it. He mediated between the Auto Alliance, who is the manufacturers, and the Alaska Auto Dealers Association, who of course are the local dealers. And we came up with some front of you. And you know what, we're certainly glad that this thing moved forward, and we're very positive about it, and it sets up some good language that protects both us and our customers. So again, I'd appreciate your support in passing and moving the bill along. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. And I think you brought up a good point that this bill is neither for the auto dealers or the manufacturers, but it's for our constituents, the consumers. And I don't know that we've stressed that enough, that that there is quite a bit of consumer protection in this bill. And thank you, Martin, for your testimony. Okay, let's move on then to Les Nichols with the Fairbanks Nissan.
Hi, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For the record, my name is Lester Nichols. I'm the owner of Fairbanks Nissan here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm also a member and director for the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Just another piece in there, I'm also a third-generation Alaskan. I did not start on this bill, as I just purchased this store about 2 years ago. And thank you for Senator Coghill for introducing the original version, Senator Myers for sponsoring the Senate version. And I got to say that growing up, my parents were entrepreneurs, and they always said that a good deal was only good if it was good for everybody. And the bill you have in front of you fits that criteria. There are three groups that this needs to be good for, and that's Alaskan consumers, dealers, and manufacturers. And I agree that initially it seemed like it was going to be a tough thing to accomplish. Representative Klayman deserves a special thanks, because the work that he did in mediating those interests in this bill was phenomenal. I haven't sat through the process with him and Sarah and the other dealers in the alliance. That was it was incredible to watch it all come together, and it took a lot of work on his part. So, again, a special thanks to him. I don't want to repeat anything either. I want to help us get through this as quickly as possible. But I do want to point out that a number of years ago, you know, there's a lot of Alaskan auto dealers. There's not anymore. There's only seven of us left. And if you look at all the dealerships in the state that are new car franchises, if it's not one of us seven, it either belongs to Lithia or to Kendall. And that's not to say anything bad about them. They're obviously, you know, bringing their businesses here to Alaska, which is great. But it's very tough to start a car dealership. This bill helps Alaskans protect the work that we put in to create a legacy. I have a three-year-old and a four-year-old, and the ability to hand this down to my children, that'll be fourth-generation Alaskans, if they are so capable and inclined, is a huge thing for me. It's part of what I'm working for. This bill helps protect that, as we've discussed. You know, and we, being in Fairbanks, we're a long ways from everywhere, but thankfully we're connected by roads. The ability for us to take people that are between Anchorage and Fairbanks is huge, whether you're going down in the Glen or whether you're headed out towards Valdez. There's a lot of people that need that assistance, and trying to get that assistance to them without this bill will continue to be very cumbersome. This bill will take care of them in a way that we've never been able to before. you know, the protections will help protect the money that we invest as dealers in Alaska should the economic winds change again, as they did in during the auto crisis. This will help us keep what we have here and keep it in Alaska. And again, being able to be fairly compensated for the service work that we do frees our hands to handle warranty issues when we find them, as opposed to when the customer notices them. That's another thing that I thought was a fantastic change for this. This whole bill just brings us current. It's nothing huge or radical, and it's something that we really need your help on. And most importantly, because of Representative Klayman and his involvement, and it's been worked out with the cooperation of the Manufacturers Alliance, I just want to express again, this is a good deal because it had input from everybody, and it is good for everybody. So I respectfully ask you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Nichols, any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for joining us today. So everyone I have online and to testify anyway, and then we do have Mr. Sleeper for questions. And then I'm going to come now here to Juneau and Mr. Elwine, who sold Senator Egan his car, is going to testify. Mr. Elwine, thank you for joining us. And I know you've been here to the Capitol many times, so hopefully you won't have to come back quite as often in the future. Mr. Elwine.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Steve Elwine. I am a local car dealer here in Juneau. I've been here for 30 years, and in spite of that, I've sold Senator Egan several cars.
Many.
Many cars. I am also a member of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association Board of Directors, and I am the state director for the National Automobile Dealers Association. I'm not going to drag you through all of this, but the things I will tell you about this is there's a couple things that are really important about this House bill. Yes, I've been working on it for a long time. I'll get into the thank yous at the end. But House Bill 136 serves to update state franchise law, and it hasn't been updated since about 2002 when it was originally written. It serves to provide us as dealers, and Les actually has it wrong. There's actually 9 of us in the state, okay, because there's a dealer in Kodiak, and we tend to forget about her. Okay. But there's 29 new car dealers in the state of Alaska, including the folks from Lithia that is a publicly held group. The Kendall Group, however, is not. It is a privately held group, and it's a family organization, much as ours. It's just very large. But they do have investments in the state of Alaska. We have 6,900 direct and indirect employees in the state. That's the number of people that we employ in the state of Alaska. This bill will serve to protect our employees and consumers throughout the state, especially those in remote areas. This is something Senator Wilson was referring to earlier. The bill does address dealer succession, and I won't drag you through this whole deal, but it clarifies things where if you have qualified people in your organization, the manufacturers can't jump in the way with a right of first refusal, so you can't sell it to your children if they're qualified. In my case, my wife, who is actually the Chevrolet dealer, is a minority dealer, is a qualified operator. If I passed in a given situation, the manufacturer could step in and say, no, she doesn't have the right to operate that. This fixes that situation. It addresses and clarifies dealer terminations. You know, if we get on the outs between the dealer and the manufacturer, maybe we're not getting enough cars or they've created a new program and we're not living up to it in their eyes. This sort of clarifies statutes that have been on the books for a long time. But here's the important part. That's things that protect us as dealers. But the things that are really important in this are a couple of things. This bill addresses manufacturer warranty issues and recalls. And, of course, recalls are top of the mind for every consumer in this state and in the country. All we've got to say is airbags and Takata all in the same breath. This bill provides that a dealer is going to be compensated at a level that's the same as retail that we charge a consumer when they walk in the door. Now, in fairness, I charge Senator Egan more than that because I have to put up with him. But the benefit of that is that means we're allowed to invest more in the equipment and in the personnel, you know, so that we can do a better job for our consumer. Under the current statute, and this is important to a consumer, current statute says that if I'm in there and I'm affecting a warranty repair on somebody's automobile and I find something else that's wrong, that's a warranty issue, under the current statute and under current guidelines from the manufacturers, I can't make that repair. Now, they may say, yeah, you go ahead and make that repair. But when the auditor comes in later, the auditor goes, no, customer didn't ask for this, and they charge us back. So we lose on that. So that's one of the things that this bill fixes, okay? We were talking about customers in outlying areas. Well, Juneau is an outlying area, okay, because we don't have all the manufacturers represented in this community. So this forces the manufacturers to address warranty concerns and recall concerns for customers who have made new purchases in communities maybe where there's not representation. But the benefit is, to the manufacturer and to the dealer, it allows a little more of a fudge factor to where they can reach into that community, find somebody that's qualified, do it directly, if that serves the customer better. On the other hand, it gives them the option to say, no, we can't do that with this particular repair, and then they face bringing it back to the dealer. Now, Senator Wilson had asked the question about, well, what's the time frame on that? We live in Alaska, so the time frame is how quick can you get it done and what's appropriate, you know, because it's the things we deal with. That's the best answer I can give you. But I can assure you, from both the manufacturer and the dealer's perspective, we want these things done and we want them done now. Because of the efforts of Representative Klayman, he really did do a good job. He helped bring all the parties together. But I want to go off script here for a second, and as my friend Senator Egan would say, Steve should never go off script. The fact of the matter is, my associates were correct when they said we started this adventure 4 years ago. We had the support of Senator Coghill. Thank you, Senator. We had the support of Senator Meyer. Thank you, Senator. And, yes, we had the support of Representative Klayman, and I had the support of my friend Senator Egan. We could not have gotten to this point to where this bill has metamorphosed without you. I'm happy to answer any specific questions you've got, and I hope you would give this bill the green light. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Alwine. Senator Wilson, did your questions get answered to your satisfaction?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions from anyone? Committee? Senator Coghill, you look like you're pondering.
No, I'm just pleased to see a final document here in front of us, that's all.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's a pretty good piece of work.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Alwine. And thank you for all your time involved in this as well. Okay, I don't see anyone else here in Juneau or online who wants to testify. So with that, I will close public testimony. And we'll bring the bill back before the committee. Any committee discussion or thoughts? I think we should. Everybody's in such good agreement now. We should move this before somebody changes their mind. Huh?
Getting close.
Okay. All right. So there's no more committee discussion. Senator Giesel. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Giesel, I'm sorry. There is a zero fiscal note on this. There shouldn't be. shouldn't be any impact to the state of Alaska. Okay. Go ahead, Senator Giesel. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to move this bill. I've only been here 8 years, and I'm very familiar with this bill. In addition, there are heavy commercial equipment franchisers who are also having similar problems with their manufacturers, and I have that bill. I'll be using this one as a model. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 136, version 30LS0561/November, from this committee to the next with zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Any objection? Seeing, hearing none, then the bill does move from committee, and I believe the next committee referral is the floor, or Rules Committee. So, all right. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, I'm going to bring the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. The next item on the agenda is SJR 9, Constitutional Amendment to the Permanent Fund Dividend. Senator Stedman, if you want to join us, and your trusty staff, David Scott, no? Okay. yeah. Okay, looks like you're flying solo here, Senator Stedman. Senator Stedman, if you could introduce the bill to us, and it looks like you have a PowerPoint, so the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bert Stedman, Senator representing District R, which is the Island District in Southeast, everything south of Senator Egan's district. What we have, before I start, I have a cough that comes and goes a little bit, as you know, because we've worked around each other for quite some time here this winter, so I've got a little bit of water and I might stop and grab a lozenge or something if need be. But, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is kind of set the stage a little bit for this bill. And what we're going to talk about here is the permanent fund management. And what we're not going to, what this doesn't address, and intentionally doesn't address, and we'll go into more detail, and that's the state's fiscal system. So this is not a fiscal system solution bill, although it is a major portion of a fiscal solution. And in taking a look at the permanent fund and the creation of it, I back up for about, well, pretty close to 30 years. In Sitka, I had a little investment business going and started meeting with the city fathers and mothers about changing their permanent fund to a percent of market value, which we did over a period of about 4 years. Not too dissimilar than what's going on here. It takes quite some time to actually talk about it and get people comfortable with it and evolve it, because it's a big decision. But we, in the community there, changed the operation of the city permanent fund from an all-bond portfolio to a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds, basically 60% equities or stocks that give you growth, more growth, and 40% bonds, which gives you more income and stability, with a look back, like we've talked about in this building, that we're all familiar with, to, you know, look back 5 years for smoothing to stabilize the cash flows. So the permanent fund, Mr. Chairman, is really a composition of two major accounts, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the principal, protected principle of the Constitution, and then the earnings reserve that is not constitutionally protected. But from the state's perspective, the Constitutional Budget Reserve is a rainy day account along with a statutory budget reserve. And it's been raining, as we all know, financially speaking, for several years now. And those are pretty much diminished relative to their historic peaks. And we're in a position now where we want to look at seriously restructuring the permanent fund. But the permanent fund is something that's set in place for future generations, and it's supposed to save and grow the assets. So when we take a look at how we're going to do this, we've got to look a little bit back in history. The permanent fund for Alaska was created in 76 by a vote of the people, and it's really a storage mechanism for the wealth generated off of our finite, as we know, oil and gas and other resources. Some of the comments I'm going to make is towards the general public, that we, all of us in this room here, get into this in minute detail quite a bit, and I'll get into a little bit more detail here a little while, but this, for most of our adult lives, when I look at around the room, I graduated from high school in 1974, so this pretty much has been in place my entire adult life and has grown, and we've worked very hard to do that as a state over time. But we have let it grow, and we've added in the legislature billions of extra dollars to the constitutionally protected portion. And on this chart, we see we've got the blue portion, which is the the principal or the constitutionally protected, and the kind of a gold colored, that's the earnings reserve, which is, for those watching at home, that's your trading profits, your net gains and losses, your dividends, your interest income, that type of stuff. So one thing I'd like the public to, and my colleagues to take note of is the gold little bar, or yellow, whatever, the earnings reserve, changes a lot. And we all know that economics change, the economic conditions of the country change from year to year, month to month, or decade to decade. And we have expansions and we have contractions. And when we have a contraction, now it normally goes worldwide, we have substantial losses in our equity investments, our stock markets, our value of our corporations go down. And this is reflected in the basic disappearance of the yellow bars. So when you take a look at 1996, 1998 area, there's virtually no yellow bar there at all, somewhere around 03. And if I can just magnify that a little bit and look at kind of the permanent fund since 2000, and we go clear back and to the beginning of the permanent fund, and frankly in financial markets we can go back with fairly good data to around 1928. But if you take a look at the lighter blue that sits on top of the darker bars is constitutionally protected, and for those at home, that's the portion that the legislature cannot access without a vote of the people. But the blue bar, the trading profits and the dividends, we can appropriate that, and we do every year. That's where we pay out the dividends. That's where we do inflation proofing. That's where we're talking about getting some funds this very year for the next fiscal year to pay our bills. But I'd like you to take note of 2003. And in 2003, those are in billions. So we had $24 billion in principal and, you know, $100 million in earnings reserve. The next year, a little less than 858, a little less than a billion in earnings reserve. If we jump up to 2009, we see the earnings reserves down to 420 million. Next year, it's 1.2 billion. So when we take a look at relying on the permanent fund and pulling money out of it, we all recognize we can only pull funds out of the lighter colored bar on top. Well, some years there isn't any. And I'd like to also kind of highlight that we haven't, in the legislature, appropriated monies out of the earnings reserve other than dividends. Inflation proofing just goes into the other account. We've taken a little bit every year off for internal management of the permanent fund. It kind of runs itself, but for all significant analysis, it's basically we haven't touched it until this year. So we are having quite a discussion going on how to deal with this. And what I, the main focus of the presentation today, Mr. Chairman, is that we can look at the permanent fund from several different angles. We can look at it here from the state or from the legislative perspective as a milk cow for revenue. You know, how much can we get out of it and not have it collapse? And have that type of discussion and that type of an analysis, and we can come up with some numbers and we can start pulling money out. And, you know, maybe we get the number right, maybe we don't. And it could be driven by our budgetary needs in the operating and capital budget. Mainly the operating, which for those watching at home is our basic services, health and welfare, state patrol, prisons, fish and game, DOT, all that type of stuff, most of which goes, probably a good half of it goes directly pretty much to the communities and the people around the state. Or we can take another approach, which I think we should be doing, and that is isolating the needs of the state basically set them off the table and look at the permanent fund and say what and how, I should say, how should this permanent fund be structured and managed for its long-term viability for future generations. We have been very fortunate, our generation, that we've had huge oil wealth come in over our working life. And we're in a little dip now, but it looks like, you know, in several years, we might have another big surge for quite some time. We don't really know until we get there. But if we were to look at the permanent fund outside of our budgetary needs and ask ourselves, how should we structure it? If we didn't need the money, we didn't care, you know, how should we structure it to make it run? Clearly, from this slide, if we rely on the structure we have today and we rely on draws from the earnings reserve, there'll be times like in 2009 when there's virtually no earnings reserve, or 2003. It's just a matter of time. It's not if, it's when. So we need to take a serious look at how we're structured. And as long as there's the two components, the constitutionally protected, the darker side of the lower part of the bars, or the earnings reserve where we can appropriate out of, on the upper side, I think we're in peril of overdrawing it with all good intentions, because we cannot control the financial markets. It's worldwide driven, and sometimes, like in 08, you know, the Federal Reserve has to step in with massive stimulus to keep the economy from imploding. So if we take a look at the permanent fund and follow and not get away from the guiding principles, you know, it's a savings account, and it should be, we should conserve it for future generations. There's no doubt about it. Our forefathers set up this structure, and it's held up, frankly, worldwide as a model. And without going through, you know, the effects of purchasing power, the thief of the night of inflation, we all kind of understand that. We want to come up with something that's going to protect this. So what this proposal does, and the most, there's a couple of really critical parts, and some of them are less critical, and I'll point out some of the ones I feel are less critical. But clearly, one of the most critical parts is we need to put the earnings reserve into the corpus, into the constitutionally protected part. So the entire balance, all of it, is constitutionally protected. That means we cannot draw any money out unless we set up that mechanism also when we constitutionally protect it. We should not have ad hoc draws. When I say we, I'm talking about the current generation today and management of the state, the adults today. I don't feel should have ad hoc draws that are going to significantly or even minorly impact the future balance of the account. The monies or the value of the permanent fund is possibly to use a little bit today, but it's really for future generations, our grandkids, our great-grandkids that aren't even born yet, future generations when we have an oil field that's 100 years old. And not much future in front of it, that we have built up a massive amount of wealth for future Alaskans. And if we allow the current needs, and when I talk about current, I'm talking about, you know, today and next year and year after that, you know, in the near distant future, that we, if we let our spending desires and our budgetary desires drive the structure of the permanent fund, we could easily make a mistake that hurts our long-term objectives and goals of protecting it for the future of the kids, our future Alaskans. We take a look at what this asks to do is we, number one, combine the earnings reserve with the with the constitutionally protected principle, so the whole thing is constitutionally protected. Then we put a draw limit on it, and that is how much can we take out in percentage a year. And it doesn't matter if you have a $10 billion portfolio, $60 billion portfolio, or a $20 million portfolio, or for that matter, a $200,000 portfolio. This structure is very similar in all of them. What drives the amount of payout is your asset mix and your rate of return. So your asset mix is going to dictate your potential rate of return, and then your real rate less inflation. So if we put in a structure that doesn't alter the management, the current management structure of the permanent fund. In other words, they don't have to restructure their asset class, move from real estate to stocks or stocks to bonds or what have you. That they basically are left intact just to do their job, manage the fund, knowing at the end of every year they're going to send some funds over to Department of Revenue, and that is going to be set as a percentage number. Here we have 4.5%, and the reason 4.5% is selected is it is below their targeted rate of return, and in front of you, you can see some of the returns. I would caution you not to get too enamored over a one-year return. A three-year return is pretty short also, five-year. And then if you take a look at inception, you know, it gives you multiple-year history. But above this 4.5%, you need to have inflation cover. And historic inflation is 2.5%, and now they're using numbers less than that. But if we go back into the 30s, late 20s, it's about 2.5%. So you need a return north of the inflation target and your amount you're going to pull out. You can run that number up till there's no margin left. 4.5% gives you a little bit of room for sloppy markets. There'll be times when the Federal Reserve just gets it wrong, or there'll be an international incident, could be major wars. The policymakers could just flat blow it. It's all happened in the past. So I would suggest that we don't run it extremely tight, that we leave ourselves a little bit of room. So the 4.5% payout, and then if you take 4.5% off of your market value, so at the end of every year, say it's June 30th, because we work on fiscal years, you basically take 4.5% of the market value. Count up all your money, count up your value of real estate, count up your stocks, count up your bonds, count up your bank accounts, and you just take 4.5% of it. We could do that. What ends up happening if you just use the end of the year balance, you get too much volatility for planning from a budgetary perspective. So if we go back and say, you know, what do we want to smooth this out, we can go back and say we want to take the average of the last 2 years or 3 years. Say we say 3 years. That's easy to do. You just go back 3 years and add it up, divide by three, and take 4.5% of it. You still have a little bit too much volatility for most budget people to be real comfortable with. So a number that you find used a lot is 5 years. And we've had that talked in the building a lot in a lot of different proposals. 5 years. 5 years is a good number. We actually are now in the building, and along with this proposal, say we, you know, go back actually 6 years and use the earliest 5 years because of the timing of the calculations to make sure we know how much money we're actually putting in a pile and counting up to the 4.5%. So that's why there's a five-year average. You use the average rates of return targeted by your asset allocation, and then you add in your inflation, and you basically have your structure. So some of the most important points when we restructure this permanent fund, well, first you got to get on the road you want to be on. Do you want to be on the road that you're going to just look at it as a milk cow and strain it, which is one road, or you can go down the other road and say, I don't care what the initially what the fiscal position of the state is. I'm not going to let it drive the management and structure of the permanent fund. I want the best structure for the permanent fund, and then I'll come over here and work on this other problem. So we've got a couple things we need to do. We have, and these are rounded numbers, and I know the permanent fund changes value every day, but you know, a few days ago it was about $65 billion. So 4.5% draw, this is how it would work. We got to pay dividends to the people. Some say we don't have to pay any dividends. Some would argue that, you know, the state shouldn't have any of the money, and it all should go to dividends. But historically, the structure of the permanent fund is basically 50% of the available funds go to the dividend, and 50% we have retained to let the permanent fund grow. And we hear that a lot, the 50%. And we've talked about other proposals in the building where the split for the dividend is a different number. This proposed split is 2% for dividends. It would be 2% of the 4.5%. And there's nothing magical about it, 2%. It's an easy number, an easy split for the public to take a look at and see where the money's going. And the committee might, through its process, decide that they want 1.5% or 2.5% or whatever. And that's the process that we need to go through. But if we took 2% off for dividends, that leaves us 2.5%. What we want is the flexibility then to leave the 2.5% in the permanent fund if we don't need it. And although the last several years there hasn't been any discussion of that, you go back several years before that, we didn't talk about pulling money out from the permanent fund. All of the money stayed in the permanent fund. We've had lots of funds that have been reinvested, additional, above what was required for inflation proofing. So I would suggest that you dismiss the ability that this structure has to only pay out a dividend and leave the rest of it in for future generations. Or if there was a time when the state didn't need the funds and we had high oil prices like we had a few years ago, and we had a shock to the heating system or cost of fuel, so we paid out an extra dividend, we could add more to that dividend if we wanted. Or the third option would be like the times we are today and probably for the next several years, is where we, the state, would need that 2.5% to come into the state treasury to pay for the basic services, education, pioneers' homes, all that stuff. So it would have flexibility. Since 82, we've distributed about $22 billion to Alaskans. Some people would say the dividend, would have been nice to leave all of the dividend money in the permanent fund and we'd have over $100 billion or some big fat number. That's one way of looking at it. But the state of Alaska is the only state in the union where the citizens own the subsurface. So we are structured different. In Texas and North Dakota, all that money goes to the private landowner. And then we have movies like Dallas, TV shows like Dallas, because they're making a pile of money. Okay. So we want to share and continue to share the wealth that all the citizens own. If we take a look at the dollars, which is probably what I know a lot of us would like to talk about, if we use the 4.5% draw, and again, just to remind everybody at home that's watching, anything other than 4.5% would take a vote of the people to get. If we had an earthquake, if we had spendthrifts in the legislature, you know, they'd have to go to the people. So in 2020, and these are fairly close estimates, the draw would be $2.5 billion, the 4.5. Permanent fund most likely it would end with a value of about $67 billion end of that year. But that would leave $1,116,900,000 for dividends, or about an $1,800 dividend with a 2%. That would leave us $1,396,100,000 for the general fund. And markets are not linear. These projections are linear. If everything was a flat line or a slope line, but smooth, the next year you'd have a $1,900 dividend, then almost a $2,000, then a $2,100 dividend. Some people would look at that and say, that's a ghastly big dividend. Why should we give that to the people? If we didn't have the financial crunch we're in today, my personal opinion, we'd be paying out the $2,800 dividend, and we'd be having the governor with a picture with a big check in the paper, like we did before with the previous governors. You know, they all the governors wanted to be with the permanent fund head with the big check. So we have different economic times now. So the dividend should be based on the value of the portfolio, and then they get 2% of the market value over 5 years. If the economy expands, the dividend goes up. The economy shrinks, dividend goes down. If we get 1002 opened up, we have more production on oil in our legacy fields. We get Smith Bay going. All these things are going to have huge impacts on the value of the permanent fund, and the values will grow quicker when those assets come online. And also gas. You know, we start doing gas sales, it'll affect us. So this takes the politics out of the dividend. It's very mechanical. Every year, 4.5% comes out, gets split between first cut at it, it's a 2% for the dividends, and then the remaining balance, and for the next foreseeable future, it would be the state of Alaska, there's no doubt about it. But I think we can work our way out of needing reliance this heavily on the permanent fund as we go forward. And that, I guess, Mr. Chairman, is kind of the gist of it. And let me just recap a little bit, because it's a different conversation that's been in the press for months. You know, this is driven off of how to manage the permanent fund without being unduly influenced over our own financial position, good or bad, state of Alaska. And how do we set it up to split the earnings and benefit directly with the people, and have the ability of the state treasury and or leave the monies in the fund to grow. And then we can look at this projection here, and we can see roughly $1.4 billion this next year into our budget. And we all know, sitting here, we've all been up to our neck in budget mess the last several years. We know we're going to need more than that. So what we did 30 years ago in Sitka is we had a spending rate of 6%. The financial markets were a lot different then. They had a lot higher dividend yields, and the administrator at the time, he needed cash flow because we lost our pulp mill. We on the investment committee wanted a lower payout because we wanted the future value for the community. And we settled in on a 6% payout. And that's run for years, and that has been ratcheting back now, 0.25% a year. We had political difficulties in ratcheting it back because it's like, well, all government's the same. They get used to the cash flow. It's very hard to pull it back. So I would suggest, you know, hopefully we will over the next several years go forward with a discussion and a conclusion that we're going to set the permanent fund up in isolation, regardless of our needs and desires, then that we overlay that with a transition from where we are at that given time to where we need to be with the permanent fund. In other words, we may not, and this is getting kind of one step further, we may not want to say, starting in 2020, we're going to have a 4.5% payout, just bang. We might want to start, I think in the building now we're talking 5.25%. We might want to start out with a higher one and ratchet ourselves back over several years by 25 or, you know, a quarter of a percentage point or some number back so we can get to the position where we want the permanent fund to be run without undue influence. But we work in the real world, and we have real bills to pay, so we have to have some flexibility. So don't get the impression I am advocating that some one day we come in with a number and shut the door on the permanent fund and lock it up, and we can't, you know, put everybody in a pickle. We can work these things through. So, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate, after waiting 30 years, to come before your committee to talk about percent of market value. That's how long I've been working on percent of market value.
Wow.
Nothing new to me. My staff just laughs. They don't have to prepare the boss for anything. Just stick him in front of the group and it's very simple. I will make a couple notes for the, and then I'll be quiet and then open it up for take some questions. We had sent this piece of legislation back several times to the drafters. They overcomplicate it with good intentions. And for the public to, I think, become comfortable with the restructuring of the permanent fund, it needs to be very clear, very transparent. No bells and whistles of if this arm wiggles, money comes out of this hand. Just straightforward. We're going to, under this plan, we would close the door for any draws over 4.5%, and the permanent fund would manage the fund. It would be inflation-proof. We wouldn't have any inflation discussions on the floor of the legislature because it's automatically done. And we would get a check. The revenue would get a check. Coming in, we'd have the discussion on what do we want to do with our share, the state share, the 2.5%. The other 2% goes out as dividends, and then we manage the state affairs or the financial affairs of the state with what we have. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be quiet and just answer questions the best I can. And I really appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you, Senator Stedman. Sorry you had to wait 30 years for this presentation. So are there any questions from committee members? By the way, I'm keeping the committee overtime here. I hope that's not causing folks any hardship. Just a couple questions I have is, well, two. You know, some believe, I think, that our forefathers and mothers, I guess, who put the permanent fund together and the dividend. Do you think they intended the dividend to go into the Constitution as you're recommending? And if so, why didn't they do it back then?
I firmly believe that the earnings reserve needs to be rolled into the principal, and the entire permanent fund needs to be constitutionally protected. I think having the portion, the 2% dividend portion, or the split, in this case we're talking about a 4% draw, mm-hmm. So the split of the draw is open for public discussion. I think the Judiciary Committee has been working on that. My expectation is it would be less than 50-50 probability that would prevail in the final version of this piece of legislation. It is much more critical that the 4.5, the draw, is protected than the dividend.
Okay, fair enough. And then, Senator Stedman, can you tell me again how you said it's automatically inflation-proofed. So in the Yeah, that slide right there. Is that part of that 2.5% for general fund? Some of that is going towards inflation? How does it work?
No, the inflation proofing is derived as a component off of your rate of return. For instance, if you had a 2% inflation in this scenario, you would have to make over at least 6.5% okay. or more a year. And that would, so if you made 6.5% and you took out 2% inflation, mm-hmm. That leaves you the 4.5%. So if you run your draw up too high relative to the performance of your portfolio, you will erode your purchasing power. That's why it is so critical that the draw rate is less than the targeted after inflation rate of return. If you make them the same, you have no room for error, and the probability is not good that you'll step on your foot most likely.
Okay.
So you draw that down. You move that draw number down to give you some real rate of return after inflation, after your withdraw, so it's growing beyond the rate of inflation every year.
Okay, thank you, Sir Stedman. So in the example you just gave, 4.5% draw, and if there's a 2% inflation, so you need 6.5% return at least. So what if you don't get that? What's impacted? The dividend or the general fund? Or
No, that's a really good question, and I should have covered that. When you have really robust markets, we're going to pay out 4.5% a year, a five-year average, regardless of what the market does. Market could go up, market could go down, market could stay flat. Doesn't matter. 4.5% every year. There will be times, in fact, there will be more up markets than down markets on average. That's when economies get larger and larger, or the economies get larger and larger on average. That's why the markets get bigger. So there will be more years when you make extra. You'll make your 4.5% draw. You'll make your, say, 2% inflation, whatever inflation is at the time, 2.5%, whatever. And like you might make 12% in a year or 15% in a year. And now that's great because you're jumping up in your return. There will be years like when we have, go back and look at recessions in 08, 09, 2000, go back to 1978, Black Monday. And you can go back about every decade and you'll have a dip. In those dip years, you'll still get a draw of 4.5% over the five-year average, but the five-year average is going to be coming down because your market value is going down. Some would argue, well, then, from the previous year, you spent part of the principal. Let's say you only made 1% in a given year, and you take out 4.5% as an example. Some would argue, well, then you spent some of the principal. But that's true in certain regards. But that's why you want this structure, so when we have down years, you have a smooth cash flow coming out, because your up years are going to more than offset that. To turn it upside down, you just bring your payout rate to 6 or 7 or 8%, and then the down markets push your value down, your purchasing power down. You can't afford down markets. That's why it's more comfortable to have a draw rate with some cushion in it. That's why it's not at 4, 5.25, or not at 5, or not at 4.75. But that's through the public, also the discussion and the evolution in the legislature. The legislature may decide that 4.5 is too conservative. They want 4.75, or 4.8, or 5, 5.25. I think the permanent fund will have some discussions or some input on some of that, what rates they're comfortable with. But there will be times when you have a down market, and it could last for 2-3 years.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Committee questions. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Senator Stedman, tell me about what you're calculating for the population during these 4 years you've portrayed.
1% growth.
I think it's growth.
I think what we did on these, we took the amount of dividends that they paid, the number, and just divided it into the dollars. I don't have the equation here in front of me, but that's how we derived the $1,800. So I think it was $615,000. Actual dividend checks are paying out. Trying to get it as close as we could. And then population historically has been growing at 1. I think lately it's been shrinking. So if population shrinks, there's, you know, the in this case, the 1.116 billion, you know, it'd be divided amongst fewer people.
Okay, Senator Geisel.
Senator Stedman, I think that if, well, first of all, I don't question at all the mathematical accuracy of what your calculations show or the mathematical logic of it at all. But as someone who deals in the realm of people, if we had a dividend that was growing like this, I believe our population would grow. And I believe that our Medicaid costs would mushroom, to say nothing of Office of Children's Services issues and our substance abuse issues. And again, I'm not thinking about this in a mathematical way. I'm thinking about the impact that this kind of a dividend of over $2,000 will have on people. So this is pretty serious as I look at it. In a negative way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Geisel.
May I respond, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please do, Senator Stitter.
The draw rate was driven off of the asset allocation, their investments, and then performance, and that's what set that. The dollar amounts are driven off of the happenstance of the size of the fund, $65 billion or $60-some billion dollars. And the five-year average just happened to be what the average was. If and through the process that the legislature felt that 2% of the for a dividend is too big, you could take it down to 1.5 and add 3 over on the other side, add that 0.5% to the general fund. You can move those numbers around to whatever the legislature feels comfortable. But to get the... At the end of the day, we need, I firmly believe, the public support for a constitutional amendment to restrict, to collapse the earnings reserve into the corpus and block the legislature's ability to do ad hoc withdrawals or we're going to spend the money.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Geisel. Thanks, Senator Stedman. Senator Calkill.
Senator Stedman, I so agree with you on the management structure of collapsing the earnings reserve into a what this is an endowment approach that that really locks this into it takes it out of the volatility area and settles it down. I really appreciate that. I do honestly struggle with putting a constitutional amendment in for the right of a dividend. I just struggle with that. So and I've made that pretty clear all along the way. So, in looking at this, I would much rather have a approach that you have here. I think this is an excellent approach of managing the wealth. And then I would much rather have this wealth then go and describe a dividend in statute that could be revisited. And I'll tell you why I think that. First of all, I don't want to put it alongside any other right in our Constitution. That's number one. Secondly, we struggle with how to determine residency in Alaska, our military coming and going, people who are moving all the time, and yet say, you know, by way of swearing that they're going to come move back, you know. I think we'd have to have a real look at how we deal with that if we're going to put it in as a constitutional right. And I just don't know how I would do that right now. So statutorily, I think we probably have a better way of managing that than constitutionally. I just struggle with it. I don't know the answer to it. I think this is a marvelous piece of work outside of that. And so I'm going to I listened as intently as I can, but that's a principle that I struggle with that you and I have just not been able to work through at this point, mainly because once you make it a constitutional right, then the citizenry of Alaska will have a hard time being unique in its description, but it'll be unique in its right. And so I think the question that was brought up by Senator Geisel then becomes even a bigger question yet, because people would move in just for a right. So I struggle with that. And I think that as I look at this, I'm going to try and figure out how I can find a way to get to where you want to go, because I think this is the best management structure I've seen to date.
Okay. Senator Stebbins.
Suggestion?
Yes, please.
I think it's a subject matter that should be discussed in judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be surprised or opposed to the constitutional protection of the dividend portion removed,
mm-hmm.
or the dividend portion adjusted with some flexible formula, something like that. I think that needs to get worked out in the process. Again, the key point here is to protect the entire permanent fund with a constitutional protection from us, mainly, with all our good intentions, and that we come up with a comfortable draw, a safe draw. I like 4.5. I know it's probably on the lower side for a lot of people, but there's a political process we go through, and whatever that draw is, it is. I don't think the legislature is going to put a draw rate that's going to be too excessively high, because I think the permanent fund would object, because they would see erosion of value. So I think those concerns that both Senator Geisel and yourself bring forward are just part of the process that we go through when we each committee works on a bill and changes it. But we just want to keep looking over our shoulders at the end of the day, because we want the public to support what we do. And I recognize the concern of a growing dividend and the value. I remember when this portfolio was $8 billion, I thought it was big. Now it's 60. And you go forward a few years just on this slide, it's 72. There's a chance in the 2023 will be, And it's as easy to turn $100 billion into $200 billion as it is 10,000 to 20. The magic of compounding. So I think it would be a legitimate discussion on how to control size of the dividend, because we may end up with a portfolio nest egg for our children, which would be ideal, that is phenomenally big, and run the state off it.
Chairman, I appreciate the comments. There's two things I like about this, especially the comment that he said that this should be preserved for generations in Alaska, and then the structure is a tried and true methodology. And I think we should move this along to judiciary. And because of the kerfluffle that I've had in judiciary over the last few days, I would commit to the senator that I would bring it up for discussion, because he may question that. Because I think this is probably as good a methodology as I've seen to date. In all the years that we've been discussing this, this is the cleanest way of doing that I've seen. And I think it should be coming up bring it up for discussion. We're at the 11th hour, but it's still an important part of the conversation.
I think those that think the proposal is, the proposal in concrete and thou shalt not change it, it's perfect, are going to be surprised. I am adamant of constitutional protection of the corpus and preferably the earnings reserve and closing that door. The dividend structure, the payout structure, that's all just the process of the discussion. And I think there is problems, downside to constitutionally putting in the dividend in. No doubt about that. And the growth of very large dividend does attract some social issues, because we all see the Hess budget. And it, frankly, and that's scary.
Okay, so let's go to public testimony, and I don't see anyone. Am I not seeing things correctly? Okay, now let's go ahead and close public testimony. Okay, is there any committee discussion? I think I heard the judiciary chair saying he wanted this, so I'm happy to let him have it. You got quite a bit of work already, though, Mr. Chair. Does Senator Coghill comment? Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, based on the events in my committee of the last week, there are people very, very interested in this, but they're interested quite often for reasons that are not similar to what this senator brought this bill forward for. And I think what we need to do, and I think it's our responsibility, I totally agree with the focus. It's our job to bring as much stability to this as we possibly can. And we have created a treasure that just needs to come to the time of life that it is so it can go on to the next generation. And just by the virtue of the draws that we are now looking over our shoulder or looking over the banister to draw in our earnings reserve and create a real cash flow problem, it's important that we have this discussion, I think. So I think, and we've looked at probably four different methods of doing this. This is probably the cleanest that I've seen of all that we've ever proposed, including your original proposal. So, yes, I think we should move it on and take a look at it.
You're not going to make the good senator wait 30 years, are you? Is there any other questions from the committee members? Okay, well, there's no cost to the state to do this, apparently. So zero fiscal notes. That's what it says.
Constitutional amendment.
It's putting them on the
Regular ballot.
On the ballot.
Oh, okay. Doesn't have a finance referral?
Yes, it does.
It does have finance. Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. So, if there's no other comments, then Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Joint Resolution Number 4, Version 30, LS1085/Omega, from this committee to the next, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. If there's no objections, and the bill will move from committee. So thank you, Senator Stedman. So with that, the committee will be adjourned. Please stay around for the book to sign, the recommendations. We do have a meeting scheduled for Tuesday. We're under the 24-hour rule, so we could expedite that, but I don't see anything on the agenda that needs to come up prior to next Tuesday, so we'll just go ahead for now. Keep our Tuesday meeting at the same time. And if something changes, we'll certainly let you know. So with that, if there's nothing else come up.
At least I got all wind up my back.
Yeah, yeah. If there's nothing else coming for the committee, thank you so much for staying over, and we're adjourned.